This is the first all-night session I've ever attended. You people often do this. You go 3-4 hours at a time. Makes it interesting. Well, you can be very happy that I've decided to cut my message in half. And reminds me of country preacher that he was his first week at the pulpit. And he was really trying to impress the congregation. And he started in Genesis. And he was going through Genesis. And he got to Exodus. And he bombed through the law books. And then he came over to the Psalms. And got to be about 12 o'clock. And finally, about 12:15, he was over there on Isaiah, and 12:30, he got over to Daniel. And when he got there, he said, "Now, where are we going to put Daniel?" An old codger stood up in the back. He said, "You can put him right here. I'm leaving." So, you may feel like leaving before long. But if you feel like going to sleep, just go ahead. Just don't snore, because you might wake the guy next to you up. I don't know if Chuck or Lauren ever mentioned this to you people, but a few years ago, Lauren White and Chuck Strittmatter and I went hunting. And we went bear hunting. And these guys claim to be quite the bear hunters. So my dad owns a cottage up in the northern woods up in New York, and so I invited them to come up and hunt with me. So in the morning, Lauren, he was the first guy, he said, "I tell you what, you guys, I'm pretty experienced in this hunting business. So, tell you what, I'll go out and I'll get me my bear first, and I'll be back in 1 hour." So he took off, and so Chuck and I decided to have breakfast while he was gone. And about 1 hour later, sure enough, here he came dragging this great big black bear behind him. We were kind of impressed. I said, "That's nothing from where I come from. Back where I come from, we don't use guns to kill bears. We use bow and arrows. I'll be back in a half an hour." So Lauren helped finish my breakfast, and half an hour later, here I came dragging this big bear behind. And they were kind of impressed. But you know Chuck. He said, "Look, you guys, where I come from, we don't hunt bear with guns and bow and arrows. We use our fists. We club them to death. I'll be back in 15 minutes. So he takes off and he starts heading up this little hill. And he sits down on this log and he thinks, "Now, how am I going to get out of this?" And just then he hears a rustling back here and he looks around and there's a big bear staring at him. And he gets up and he runs for the cabin and he's yelling, "Help, help, open the door, help, open the door." And just as he gets there, we get the door open and in he goes and he circles around the table and the bear right after him, he slams the door behind him, he says, "Skin that one, I'll be back with another." Well, after those skits, I was pretty sure I couldn't do any worse. I better not say any more, right? They were done valiantly, let's put it that way. Well, seriously, I had considered covering 2 chapters of James tonight, but I'm afraid some of you would grow very, very weary. And I would rather not take the chance of doing that. So I think we'll skip chapter 3, which is on the tongue, which is one of my favorite chapters. So it's very hard for me to skip this chapter. But I think I best. One of the reasons I don't like to skip it is I have two of my best jokes in it. I think all of you are familiar with the wheel. How many here are not familiar with the wheel illustration? Let me see your hands. You haven't seen the wheel illustrations. Come on. Okay, phew. All right, almost everybody knows the wheel illustration. I'm not an artist, as you'll soon see. No rim on this one. Well, there's one. Pretty good, huh? Okay, thank you. What goes in here?
Oh, no.
What goes in there?
Which one?
This is a different one, isn't it? This one. Yeah.
The word.
The word, okay? Good. We don't spell too well in service, so we appreciate it. The word. How many knew that? About half. That's great for college students. Okay. How about this one? What's up here? Prayer. Well, we're getting a little better response. How about over here?
Fellowship.
That's the new wheel, isn't it? Oh, yeah, new generation. Okay. What's over here? What's the rim? What's that? Okay. Now, if this is a wheel on a car, and let's say it's a back wheel, what do you call this on that wheel? Hub. Okay, what takes place in there? Some mechanic genius, tell me. What goes on in there?
Motivation.
I think you're more of an engineer than you are a mechanic. Okay, somebody else in a little different terminology. What else goes on in there? What takes place in there? Power. Yeah, power. And the driving force. Without the power and the driving force in this thing, the wheel would be absolutely worthless. And so what we're talking about tonight is the lordship of Jesus Christ in the life of the believer. And so you could have the word, prayer, fellowship, witnessing, all of this in good tack, a bunch of great folks. But if you aren't in rich communion with Jesus Christ, there'll be no power in your life. There'll be no drive. You'll be a very proficient machine. How many here have read The Black Cat, Edgar Allan Poe's Black Cat? All right, that's a few. You can check up on me to see if I've got the story correct. First of all, I'll read you some statistics from a newspaper in Washington, D.C., the Washington Post. The first 10 days of the year, I was going to bring a magazine in here and point out some of these latest things, but you're up on them as well as I am. You know what's going on in the world. Tragedies, strifes, The first 10 days of January, out of D.C., there were 5 hijacks. There were 200 holdups in the first 10 days of the year in Washington, D.C. 20 armed robberies a day in our capital. In 1967, for the whole year, there were 29 bank robberies. In 1968, there were 102 bank robberies. And in the first 10 days of this year, there were 200. In 1967, there were 22,424 armed robberies. In 1968, there were 4,640 armed robberies in Washington, D.C. On the second day of this year, there was a robbery, armed robbery of a bank a block and a half away from the White House. Another statistic that I got the other day, there are 15,000 people in Washington, D.C. on heroin. And this statistic also listed that for a person on heroin, it takes $100 worth of serum a day for them to be able to keep going. Now, if you've got 15,000 people in one city that are on heroin, that need $100 a day, it's pretty obvious that the robberies are going to mount up, aren't they? And you wonder, where in the world the end of all of this is coming? What's going to happen next? When I was in college, I read this article or this short story by Edgar Allan Poe, The Black Cat. And some of you may not have known that have read it, that he wrote that as his philosophy of the nature of evil. And I believe that it's the greatest rendering I've ever heard on the nature of evil. He comes home from work one day, and this black cat meets him at the door, and he kind of likes it. So he reaches down, and he pets the cat, and they become friends. The next night he comes there, and the cat's there, and rubs against his leg, and he pets it. He carries it in and pets it a while, and they become the best of chums. Before long, something happens in Edgar Allan Poe. He doesn't like this cat anymore. So he, you know, get away from me, starts kicking it. Pretty soon he throws it out the door. And pretty soon he decides to get rid of this cat. So he gets a bag, and he puts this black cat in this bag, and then he ties a rope around it and puts a rock to that, and he goes and drops it in the river, about 20 miles away. So when he gets home, of course, there's the black cat. And he gets mad. And so he takes out his penknife, he grabs the cat, and he gouges the eyes out of it. And then he throws it off. Hates that thing. But every night, that cat, as soon as he comes home, rubbing against his leg, trying to get in the door, and he finally gets so mad, he grabs the cat, and he gets a rope, and he puts it around the neck, and he hangs it in a tree in the backyard. So he goes back into the house, and he's sitting in the easy chair reading the newspaper, and all of a sudden, crash. And he goes into the bedroom, and there's a fire and in the wastebasket or something. So he gets the fire put out, and then he sees the cat there. And this cat is so attached to him that he wanted to save his life. He got off that tree some way. And he just goes into an outrage. And he starts trying to catch that cat, and he runs it down into the cellar, and he gets his wife to help him, and he gets the axe, and he starts swinging at that cat, and he missed, and he hit his wife, and he split her head wide open. Well, now he had a problem. So he bangs out the wall, chips it out, and he puts her in there real nice, and then he plasters it over. So pretty soon the cops come, and which happens usually in Edgar Allan Poe's stories. Police come, knocking on the door. He invites them in. He says, "Oh, isn't it a wonderful day? Come and have tea with me." And so they have tea, and they said, "Well, we were just answering a complaint. Somebody said there was a lot of noise over here." "Oh, everything's fine." So they were just getting ready to leave, and he says, "Isn't this a marvelous house? The walls, aren't they solid? You know, it's really a well-built house." And they're pretty smart, you know. So they finally get the hint, so they go looking around at the walls, and they go down in the cellar, and they find this this plaster. So they dig it out, and there they find his wife. And sitting on top of her head is that black cat. And that's the way it ends. Now that is really good when you think about it. He kind of liked this thing a little bit. And this little black cat represents sin. And he got to liking it. And they became the best of friends. And he petted it. And he had it as a buddy, as a chum, as a thing. And then he started to get to the place where he didn't want it anymore. And so he decided, "I'm not going to do it anymore. I'm not going to have it anymore." But he couldn't get rid of it. And he tried to kill it. He tried to destroy it. But he couldn't. It had it. I'd searched out several men's philosophies on the nature of evil. This was by far the best. But he, along with the others, didn't have a solution. Because in case you don't know, the great poet, Edgar Allan Poe, the great writer, died one of the most miserable deaths a man could die in the streets of Baltimore, Maryland. He was found in a gutter, and he had died from drinking. He was an alcoholic. He was penniless when he died. He was a bum, worthless bum, and they said he was about 80% insane when he died. In fact, they claim he was about 50% insane when he wrote most of his writings. That's not hard to figure out. He had a great philosophy on the nature of evil, and I think he had himself in that cat. And that cat represented liquor in his life, and probably some other things. But the very thing that he tried to get rid of, he couldn't, and it killed him. It ruined him, it destroyed his whole life, and it killed him. And some of you are playing around with that kind of stuff. Well, it might not be liquor. And if you're not now, you will. Some of you guys get into the service, get overseas where nobody knows you. You're going to get temptations you haven't had before. This year, you're going to have temptations you've never had before. Satan's going to see to that. And if you give in, and you dabble with it a little bit, you play with it a little bit, it's like cancer. It just kind of gets you. It gets eating away. I talked to a drunk once. Stopped me, he wanted a dime. And I said, "Well, I tell you what, I'll give you a dime. If you let me tell you something." He said, "Go ahead." So I shared my testimony with him. And he said, I was partway through it, and he said, "Just a minute, son, just a minute. Listen," he said, "I know all those verses." He says, "I know 1,000 verses." He said, "I was like you once." And he started to cry. He said, "Son,
Don't start drinking. Don't start drinking. Now look, you going to give me your dime or aren't you?
I said, yeah, here's your dime. You never think you're going to end up that way, do you? Just a little bit. Just feeding the yearning of my heart just a little bit. Well, let's turn to chapter 4. Let's see what this has to say. James chapter 4. Pretty current rendering, isn't it? From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence, even of your lusts that war against your members? Ye lust and have not. Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not because ye ask not. You may recall the first chapter, and verses 13 through 16 says, let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God, for God cannot be tempted, neither tempteth he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. And when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. Okay, that was the introduction to this chapter right here. Lust is a pretty old problem with us. I've had guys tell me, Harv, I don't have one lust. And I used to call him a liar. But I don't have to anymore because there's a Bible verse that calls him a liar. And so I just show him that Bible verse and we'll get to that. But we're pretty familiar with these problems of lusts. And they're not very new. There's nothing new under the sun. That's what Solomon said. And in Genesis 3, verse 6, we see the first rendering of a problem with lust. And you remember the story pretty well. That little rascal Eve, she's the one that caused the whole works here. It says, and when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat and gave also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. Now, it's rather interesting. First of all, she looked on the tree, and it really looked good. And then it was pleasant to the eyes. Lust of the eye. Then she took it and ate it. Lust of the flesh. And the pride of life, Satan had just said, Eve, if you eat of that fruit, you'll be as wise as God. The pride of life. There's a verse like that in the New Testament, isn't there? Somebody quote it? Anybody? Lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life? Come on. Check some of you guys out on your verses one of these days. Yeah. A little louder.
Do not love the world, the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in it. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world.
Yeah. It's nothing new. John wrote the same thing. Lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. The very thing that caused Eve to Turn her back on God and sin is the same thing. The same things that cause you and I to turn our back on God and sin. Lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, the pride of life. Thumbing through a magazine the other day, I came across this little thing right here. It's an advertisement on diamond. And it's kind of an interesting little ad. At the very bottom it says, "The diamonds make a gift of love." That'd be very enchanting to some of you right now. But the thing that really got my attention was way down in the bottom, real small letters, it said, "A diamond is forever." And I've got news for those people. A diamond lasts a long time, but it's not going to last forever. It's all going to burn. That's what the Bible says. Revelation 19 and 20. It's all going to burn. Jeremiah 17, 9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" In Joshua 7, Achan was among the Israelites. They went in and they took over this this town, and they were commanded not to take any of the treasures from that town. But Achan, he couldn't resist. And Israel had gone through some turmoil, and God had told Joshua just who had done it. And so Joshua asked Achan, "Achan, why in the world did you steal this stuff?" He said, "I looked at it. I wanted it for me. Lust of the eye, lust of the flesh for me, that I might be somebody, the pride of life." 2 Peter 2:14, "Having eyes full of adultery." Ecclesiastes 1:8, "The eye is not satisfied with seeing." Proverbs 27:20, "Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied." Ecclesiastes 11:9, "Rejoice." I like this. It's kind of gruesome, but Solomon, he's kind of at his wit's end at this point. He says, "Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thine heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment." Go ahead. Have your fling, young man. But just remember this. God's going to bring you into judgment. In a paper not long ago, I read of four girls who had just been dug up. And they were all dismembered. They'd been chopped to pieces, and two of them, their heads were missing. Some maniac running around, just killing. And it kind of brings to light this passage in James, doesn't it? "Ye kill and desire to have and cannot obtain." Why does this guy want to kill? Who in the world knows? But he's not satisfied with killing one, or two, or three, or four. He's got to kill more and more and more. Because killing doesn't satisfy. Countries are at war all over the world. Good grief, every time you pick up the newspaper. By the way, if you want to stay real current, I won't have time to go into this, don't bother too much with what's happening around Vietnam. You check Israel and what's happening over there. A lot of these people aren't clued in on that in the newspapers. They put Vietnam on the front page and Israel over there on about the eighth page. But you keep an eye on Israel, because they're the ones that are going to be telling the story. All of prophecy, it's all around Israel. And according to the prophecies that have been fulfilled, the time is ripe. And it's getting riper and riper all the time. Man, I'd like to go off on that, but I better not. Countries are at war, and a country wants more land, and more land, and more land. They want more power. They never get enough. Charlemagne, he had all of the, I don't know how much, but the known world or something, and history says that he cried because there wasn't any more land to take. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not. And young people today are really getting sidetracked with the dope and the marijuana and the pill and the needle and the glue. It's not going to do it. I saw some pictures of some kids over in Thailand, where they can get all this stuff that they want, and they're sitting upstairs in attics, and they've got their swarms, and they're sitting there and watching each other die, and they just kind of haul a body out when it finally dies, and those that are sitting around, they're skinny, and they're dying, and they're staying there sticking that stuff in their veins. And taking all that stuff in? Satan really blinds, doesn't he? Christ, the hub, the center of the life. Where's Christ in your life? Got another picture to draw. I'm so good at these circles, I thought I'd try another one. I call this the pie illustration. You ever seen the pie illustration? Oh, this is great. You can use it for anything. That's right, you can use it for I use it for witnessing once in a while. In fact, I was talking to some guys at a... I was meeting with three guys out at one of the bases, and this guy said, "Boy, Harv, you know, what I'd like to have is something in my hand that I could... something I could witness with that's real simple, that'll only take a couple minutes. Something that really stimulates interest." So I said, "Okay, here, I'll show you a pie illustration." So I started showing them this. And I said, "Okay, here we are. We'll divide this pie into four parts. And here are the questions." We were standing in a hamburger line, and I had my success diary out. And I was writing on that, showing them. And so before I knew it, there were about six or eight other heads looking in, you know. So I said, "Now let's say that it represents a young man between 17 and 22 years of age. Now, this is real hard. You tell me what the four main interests in this guy's life is at this stage of his life." Okay, somebody? What's one? Girls. Yeah, that's pretty good. Okay. Money. Yeah, there's one.
Car.
Boy, you guys are really right on. Pretty good. I usually put plans in here. And a serviceman a lot of times will say, "Drink." And, a variety of things. Some guys are very interested in sports. Some guys are interested in becoming educated. Now, by this time, these guys are really, there are about 20 guys standing around. And I'd already proved that point. It got the interest. I said, "Now let's say girls is in the middle here. We don't know how to spell too well. Girls is in here, okay? If a girl is in here, if the girl is the center of this guy's life, then where's his money going to be? Oh, he's going to spend it all on the girl. If he's got a car, wherever that car is, that girl's going to be in. And plans? Well, he'll be anything she wants him to be. That's kind of the way that goes, okay? If money's in here, money is a central desire and interest in this guy's life. He may not date many girls because they're kind of an expensive thing. And he may not have a car because that's a very poor investment if you're planning on saving money. And plans? Plans to be a wealthy man someday. In any way he can get that, that's what he's after. You put car in here? Some of you guys are hot rodders. So the guy calls up his girl, he says, "Honey, man, you're going to have to wait for another time because I'm polishing my chrome head tonight." And money? Money all goes in the car. Plans? He doesn't have any plans. He's rambling. Somewhere along the line, this young man comes across hearing about Jesus. And he hears a message and he says, "Okay, Jesus, I'll let you in my life. Here, I'll put you right here." And Jesus says, "No, I don't want that place." "Oh, okay. Put you over here." And he says, "No, I don't want that one either. What do you want?" "Want this one, right?" Jesus is the center of your life. And if Jesus is the center of your life, then you'll be sensitive with your money to give what you're able to him. If Jesus is the center of your life, you're not going to be running around trying to date every gal around. You're going to be really trusting God to show you his choice for your life. There's a verse on that. Romans 12:2. "Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind." Or as Phillips puts it, "Don't let the world squeeze you into its own mold." And I'm afraid that many times the Christians are using the world's patterns and forms for a lot of things we do. Car, he considers it before the Lord. "Lord, do you want me to have a car?" It isn't out of a desire to have a car because I want to gun it or because I want to date. Does Jesus Christ want me to have a car? Plans, he wants to become what Jesus Christ wants him to become. About this time, about 15 of these guys had left. But they got the illustration. Where is Jesus in your life? Out here? Girl is the center of your life? Then if she happens to be religious, then you'll be religious. Now, I guess I'm sure you see the picture, don't you? Colossians 4:3 in the Phillips says, "One day Christ, the secret center of our hearts, the secret center of our lives, will show himself openly, and you will all share in that magnificent denouement." One day Christ, the secret center of our hearts. That's kind of thrilling, isn't it? That's where he is. Verse 3. We're not going to finish this chapter, by the way, so don't get too edgy. "Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lusts." Jesus said, "If ye shall ask anything in my name, I will do it." John 14:14. If ye shall ask anything in my name, according to my will, I'll do it. That's a promise. But James here says, ye ask and receive not, because you ask amiss, that you may consume it upon your own lust. I was 21 years old, and I had just hung one on. My birthday. I'd really had a wild one. Came in at 2 o'clock in the morning. My mother was kneeling at the chair, which she did very often when I came in. And sometimes I'd kind of stumble over her feet. Sometimes she'd be kneeling by the bedside, and she'd have the night light on. And as I walked up to my room, I had to walk by their room, and I'd see her on her knees. But I got so hard that I didn't even care if she was on her knees. This night I got up on my in my room, and there on my light table was a little package, birthday present. So I opened it up, and it was a Bible. And I thought, good grief. What are you going to do with that? I thought, man, what a thing to get for a birthday present. Well, I was between a rock and a hard place, and I thought, well, I probably better look at this thing anyway. So it was a Revised Standard Version of the New Testament. And so that, you know, that intrigued me. I'd never seen one of those before. And so I started thumbing through it, and I flipped open to James. I thought, well, I can tell Mother tomorrow I read something in it. And I turned to this chapter. And when I got to the fourth verse, I read this. Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore shall be a friend of the world is the enemy of God. And that knocked the tar out of me. And I just started to cry. And I got down on my knees by my bed. And I asked God to forgive me and to cleanse me. I could go on and on in my testimony. I'd kind of like to do that. That lasted for a little while. I'll go into just a little bit of it. 3 minutes. I fortunately found a Christian buddy at this point, and we did a lot of chumming around together, and I was doing pretty well until October 5th, 1950. I got a phone call at my place where I was working. It was our family doctor. He said, Harv, you better come right down. Your mom and dad were in an accident. And so I raced on down to the hospital. And when I got there, Mom was dead. And she had died of a broken neck. And that kind of shook me up. Dad was all crushed in his ribs and everything, but he came through it. 2 days later, I got my draft papers. So I got a 2-week deferment from the Army, and on the 14th day, I joined the Navy. And so when I went into the Navy, my buddy was there to say goodbye, and we shed some tears together, you know. And I said, boy, I'm really going to witness to those guys down there. I'm really going to go to it. And I got to boot camp, and in 3 days, I was completely shot down. Out, out, out. And then I got in the Blue Jackets choir, and that thing was kind of famous during the war, you know. They went traveling all over, and wasn't quite as famous at this point, but we traveled some, and I got a lot of special liberty because of it, which enabled me to do a lot of dating, and I got in all kinds of trouble before I even got out of boot camp. I got down to Norfolk, Virginia, and in those days they called that the hell hole of the nation, and that's what it was. I don't know what it is today. But I got down there, and boy, I really went all the way whole hog. Well, I'd been a Christian. I was raised in a godly home. And I'd made many decisions. I really had. I had worn a path to that altar. Every time an evangelist came, I made another decision. And 2 weeks later, I'd be right back out where I was. And there are a lot of people that have had backgrounds like that, completely disappointed with their Christian lives. They've made decisions, made decisions, made decisions, and they finally decide it doesn't work. And that's pretty much what I had decided. And my life was such a misery that next year and a half, I had a date every night for months. And I got so sick and tired of girls, literally, that I just quit dating and I decided to stay on the base. So I started playing cards. Man, I'd play cards all night long and made a little money. But pretty soon, that kind of wore off. And I didn't know what to do then. So I just started going to the movies. And I started going to 2 movies a night, from one to the other. And I did this for several months. And finally, I realized that my life was being shaped by movies. One night, I came out of a mystery, and I felt like this, you know. And then I remembered the one before that, I'd come out like this. Fred Astaire in those days. Quite a ways back. And, you know, he had been dancing and all this gleeful thing, and, man, I'd come out and I was dancing and whistling. I thought, man, I'm just a mock of these dumb movies I'm going to. So I quit going to movies. Well, there wasn't anything else to do but sleep. So I started sleeping. I slept more, and I slept more and more, and I started sleeping 16 hours a day. I didn't get up for breakfast. I had a job that I didn't have to check in. I only had to work a half an hour a day. So all I had to do was go check in with the captain, and I handed the dispatches to him, and I'd go back, I'd eat lunch, and I'd go right to bed. And I slept all night long until about 8:30 or 9 the next morning. And pretty soon they couldn't wake me up. And this scared me, because not long before that, really, they'd have to stand me up, and a couple times they put me in the shower, and I remember they hauled a guy off like that, just bunky, about 2 bunks down, and he never came back. So I had my own remedy, so I started hitting the town again. Wine, women, and song. And it was during this time that a guy grabbed a hold of my sleeve down on East Main Street. And he said, come on out to our church Sunday and we'll have you out for chicken dinner. And so I said, well, is it a good fundamental church? And he said, yeah, it really is. I said, okay, give me the directions. So he gave it to me. That was Saturday night, and I was on my way to a dance. So the next day was Sunday, but I remembered that I had a date with the Queen of Norfolk. I had been working on this a while, and I had it all set up for that next Saturday night. And I knew those, you know, years ago when I went to church, I'd get convicted and I'd change, and then I didn't go to dances anymore. So I thought, well, man, I better wait a week. So I waited. I didn't go to church that Sunday. And the next Saturday night, I picked up this gal, and she was beautiful. But my heart was so sick, I could hardly stand it. We went to this dance, and I couldn't dance. I just couldn't dance. And so I'd go out for a walk, and guys would dance like mad with her, you know. And I'd come back, and I'd start dancing again, and I couldn't dance. So finally, I said, come on, let's go. She says, oh, where are we going? I said, we're going home. Oh, you're kidding. And so as we kept progressing toward her house, she got kind of frantic, and she just really got mad, and she started crying. And when we got to the house, I said, "Get out!" And so she got out and slammed the door, and off I went. The next morning, I went to church. And I went to church all day long. I went to morning service, and then I went for my chicken dinner, and then I went to young people's, and then I went to evening service, and then we had young people's party. And that night, on my way back to the barracks, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. I had trouble getting buses, and I had to walk about a mile on the base. And as I walked, I said, "God, I don't know. Is there any use? Is there any purpose in my even trying again? I've tried it so many times. Why will it work this time?" And I finally said, "Well, okay. Okay, God, I'll try it one more time." And so I was just going to pray, and I was beating on a weed. And so just as I was going to start praying, I put the cigarette to my mouth, and I thought, I guess I'll have to finish my cigarette and pray, or otherwise I'll have to throw the cigarette. So I had another decision to make. So I finally decided to throw the cigarette, and impulsively I reached in and threw the whole pack out in the middle of the street, and then I prayed. I said, "Okay, God, here I am. I'll give you one more chance." That's exactly what I said. And fortunately, God knew what I meant. And then I said, "Help me find somebody that can help me live the Christian life." This guy helped me a little bit. He got me in reading the Bible, and he actually got me started memorizing scripture. And I remember the first verse I learned, we were in the car going back to the base, and he said, "I'm not taking you back to the base until you've memorized a verse." I said, "I can't memorize." He said, "Yes, you can." I said, "No, I can't." He said, "Yes, you can." He said, "Memorize this verse." And so he started quoting it, and I said, "I can't do it." He said, so we're driving around town, And finally I got it, word perfect. And it was Revelation 3:20. "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and will open the door, I will come into him and sup with him and he with me." I didn't realize that that verse was going to play a big part in my life a few months later. A little bit later, some navigators came to town, and this guy that had helped us knew a navigator in another city. And so this guy wrote this friend of ours and said, "You guys get over and see the navigators." So they went over one night, and I had the duty. And the next day, one of my buddies said, "Man, you don't want to go there. They're really a weird bunch. They must be communists or something. They kind of get you off into a corner, and they get kind of whispering at you, and we're not going back there." Well, this really got my curiosity up. So, boy, that next Tuesday, I was going, and they came along, and three of us, there we sat, great big meeting, three of us, and he stood up in front of us and preached at us. And the first thing he did, he quoted Psalm 119, 9 and 11. "Wherewithal shall a young man cleanse his way? By taking heed thereto according to thy word. Thy word have I hid in mine heart, that I might not sin against thee." And a light went on. And I got so excited, I wanted to cry, I wanted to shout. For the first time in my life, I saw the solution to living the victorious Christian life. I had never been told that before in my life. The Word is what gives you the strength to be victorious. And I got so excited that I went home that night, back to the barracks, and I memorized 18 verses. And I kept memorizing as fast as I could, and I had over 200 verses memorized by the time I got the TMS. I was hungry. I knew this was the answer for my whole life. I'll stop my testimony there. First Thessalonians 5:22, you know that one? Abstain from all appearance of evil. In Proverbs, Solomon said something like that. He said, avoid it, pass not by it, turn from it, and pass away. And I view that, here's a temptation down there about three blocks. And he says, avoid it, Harv. And so I avoid it. I go off over this direction. And then there's a temptation right down the next block. And he says, pass not by it, Harv. And so I go across the street. And I don't pass by it. I come to one face to face. Solomon says, turn from it and pass away, Harv. And you do an about face and you take off, boy, you grab a hat. Abstain from all appearance of evil. When it's way out there, guys and gals, when that temptation is way out there, it's pretty easy to lick. But the closer you let it get, the more you meditate on it, the bigger it becomes, the more you like that cat. Avoid it. Pass not by it. Turn from it. And Joseph had a pretty tough one. And it was right there, boy. And he said, turn from it and pass away. And sometimes we don't turn, do we? We like to just play with it a little bit. It'll destroy you. It'll destroy you. It'll put you on the shelf. You'll be ineffective as a disciple for Christ the rest of your life. And you know what God is speaking to you about tonight. I don't know. I don't know your problem. But you know your problem. Don't you? I had a friend in Greensboro, North Carolina. Businessman. I had a businessman's Bible study up there. About 35 men in it. And this guy told me a story one day. He said, Harv, you know, let me tell you about something. Every day on my way to work, I used to go by a boat shop. And one day they put this new boat in the window. And every day I went by, I'd look at that boat. And on my way home, I'd look at that boat. Man, I like that boat. And one day I thought, man, I'm going to stop and I'm just going to take a closer look at that. So he stopped and he took a little closer look at it. Oh, man, that's nice. Got back in the car and took off. A couple days later, he decided to stop and go in and just touch it, just feel it. So he said, I went in and I just kind of looked at it. Man, that's nice. I asked the salesman, how much it cost? Guy said, oh, $4,000. $4,000? And so he just took off. A few more days, back and forth. He looked at that boat. One day he stopped in, he said, how much down payment you need? The guy said, $1,000. $1,000? So he left. Day after day he thought, what can I hawk to get $1,000? And he started thinking of stuff he could sell. And he started selling things. And he sold his car and bought a cheaper one. And he got that $1,000 and he bought that boat. And that's the way some of you are. The Holy Spirit keeps bringing to mind something that you need to get rid of. But you keep looking at it. You keep looking at it. You keep lusting after it. And you're still young. And you can get that thing committed, if you will. Or those things may not just be one. But boy, the old heart can go out after possessions, can't it? This couple, they were discussing in their dining room, and the wife says, honey, this table just doesn't go in here. Look, this round table in this room, it just doesn't fit. We need a square table. And so they said, okay, let's go down and get a table. So they went down and they got a square table. And she says, oh my, it's too big. Too big for the room. So we better make this room a little bigger. So they knock out a wall and then they make the room a little bit bigger. And then she says, oh, the dining room is bigger than the living room. And that shouldn't be. So they knock out that wall. And they make the living room bigger. Well, pretty soon, you know, that she decides, honey, we need another car. So he says, okay, we'll get a VW for you. So they get a VW. And she's bombing around in that, and she says, honey, I need a garage. And so they build a little garage for this VW next to the other garage. And so then one day she sees this nice new Valiant, and she says, honey, I'd sure like to have that Valiant. I don't like this VW anymore. So he says, okay, let's get the Valiant. So she drives home with the Valiant, and it won't fit in the garage. So now they got to enlarge on the garage. And then, you know, the Smiths and the Joneses, they've all got boats. And so they, you know, honey, we ought to have a boat. So they get a boat. Well, then, you know, once you got a boat, everybody's got a boathouse for their boat. We're the only ones that don't have a boathouse for the boat. And so they build a boathouse. And then, you know, well, as long as you got a boathouse down at the lake, you might as well build a cabin. And one day on the way back from the cabin, they're looking at the house and, isn't the house terrible? It's all out of proportion. Let's build another house. And that's the way life goes, doesn't it? People are given to building and buying and things. And their lives are all wrapped up in it. And that can happen to you if you don't get Jesus Christ right there. In Ephesians 2, 1 through 5. First of all, I guess we should look at James, where are we? Verses 5 and 6. I've deviated a little bit from my notes. Probably would have been shorter if I shared the other whole outline. Do ye think that the Scripture saith in vain, the Spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy? That's the verse I use on that fellow. Guy says, boy, you know, I don't know any problems I've got. I have him read that verse. I say, explain that. The Spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy. Let me give you a couple verses to verify that. Back here in Genesis again, chapter 6. God got kind of disgusted with the people of the world at that time, you might remember, in Noah's day. And verse 5, and God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. Now, over in chapter 8, verse 21 of Genesis, it says, and the Lord smelled a sweet savor, and the Lord said in his heart, I will not again curse the ground anymore for man's sake, for the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. Neither will I again smite anymore everything living as I have done. God just states it as a matter of fact. And we know it, don't we? Our spirits lust to envy. But he giveth more grace. Wherefore, he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. In Living Letters, Ephesians 2. This is so good, I've just got to read it to you. Where's Ephesians? Once you were under God's curse, doomed forever for your sins, you went along with the crowd and were just like all the others in your dormitory, full of sin, obeying Satan, the mighty prince of the power of the air, who is at work right now in the hearts of those who are against the Lord. All of us used to be just like they are. Our lives expressing the evil within us, doing every wicked thing we long to do. or thought about. We started out bad with evil natures born within us, and we're under God's anger just like everyone else. But God is so rich in mercy, He loved us so much that even though we were spiritually dead and doomed by our sins, He gave us back our lives again when He raised Christ from the dead. Only by His undeserved favor have we ever been saved. I don't want to end this on a negative note, but rather on a victorious note. Because we have promises galore in the Scriptures for a victorious life in Christ. And if you look at verses 7 through 10, okay, you still open to James? And this is kind of the wrap-up, so see if you can kind of get this now. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. Be afflicted, and mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, and your joy to heaviness. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he shall lift you up. You know, I had these verses misconstrued for many years. I misunderstood these verses. For years, I resisted the devil. For years, I tried cleansing my hands. And for years, I was in the business of trying to promote myself. But gang, if you'll notice, before it says resist the devil, it says submit yourselves therefore to God. Then you can resist the devil. You can't resist the devil in your own flesh. We cannot fight against principalities and powers. Only as you submit yourself to God can you resist the devil's temptation. You can't cleanse your own hands. You can't purify yourself. Only as you draw nigh to God and you've got a communion with Him can you be cleansed. And only as you humble yourself before Him will He lift you up. Not you lift you up. He lifts you up. And it's rather interesting, again, we have the analogy, lust of the eye, lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. There's a, I'm going to read a couple little things here. Read one paragraph from this. It's a book called Forever Triumphant by Hugel. Boy, is that guy on target. We simply establish the fact of victory as God's eternal and universal standard. If I may so speak, no truth could be more apparent, however intense one's study of the New Testament, that the divine standard for the Christian is a steady stream of victory. Come what may, or when it may, be the temptation ever so great, or the emergency ever so sudden, victory is ever and only God's order of the day. It is not victory now with clenched fist and set jaw. It is victory swallowed up in praise. It is victory in the midst of 10,000 hallelujahs. That's the victory that you and I have available to us. But it'll only be experienced in accordance with our communion with Him. It's already ours. We don't have to fight for it. Victory is ours. We already have it. You say, boy, I've tried to have victory, but I guess I'm too weak. Listen, I've got news for you. I've got good news. 2 Corinthians 2:14. Now thanks be unto God, which always causeth us to triumph in Christ. Through Christ, you can have victory. Instant Replay, book written by Jerry Kramer, some of his diary with the Green Bay Packers football team. He says, at our devotional service this morning, we had a guest speaker, a retired doctor who spends his time traveling around the country talking to athletes about Christ. He gave us copies of his booklet, Athletes in Action, and I began thinking about people who never make decisions about their own lives. The other day I saw a film called Cool Hand Luke, and Paul Newman played a wild character who courted disaster all his life. He had no goal, no fear, and toward the end of his life he escaped from prison two or three times. The last time he escaped, he came upon a church and went in and got on his knees and said something like this, "Oh man, what do you got planned for me? What's next, oh man? What do you want me to do? What did you put me on earth for, old man?" I ask the same questions. I often wonder where my life is heading. And what's my purpose here on earth besides playing the silly games I play every Sunday? I feel there's got to be more to life than that. There's got to be some reason to it. Many people never take control of their own lives, never say, this is the way it's going to be, and maybe I'm one of them. I didn't come up with any answers this morning. I just thought about it a while. I trust that by this time somebody has had some time with that young man. That's tragic to come that close and to come up with no answer. But he saw the problem, didn't he? Let me read you this one. Another paragraph. Guy got this from a grandmother of his. "I will soon be 66 years old, and finally I understand what it means to be righteous. I always thought it meant do right by everyone and shun nobody. My mother taught me to pray before I was 5 years old in German. Christ's blood and righteousness is my ornament and honor gown. With these I will stand before God when I enter heaven in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. I have prayed this for more than 60 years, and just this week I understand." Isn't it tragic that it took 60 years for her to understand that? And I believe from the context of her letter that she just got saved. Karl Barth, great theologian that just died a while back, said this, "Religion means man going around and around with higher aspirations, but that's not what counts. What counts is the encounter between God and man." Stated that pretty good, didn't he? Socrates said to Plato, "It may be that the deity can forgive sins, but I don't see how." And it's too bad that he didn't live a few hundred years later when he could have heard about Christ. You're standing at the crossroads tonight. Each one of you, some of you have never invited Christ into your heart. Some of you don't know for sure. Boy, Harv, I don't know. That night I was walking down that road, I said that to God. I said, "God, I don't know if I've ever really, truly asked you to come into my heart. And if I haven't, I want to do that right now. Jesus, I want you to come into my heart and forgive me of all my sins." And since that day, I've never had a doubt. Some of you aren't sure. You've gone to church all your life. You're like this old grandma. You've prayed great prayers. But you've never realized what it is to become a Christian. And boy, I want to challenge you tonight. Surrender your heart to Him tonight. Don't let one more hour go by. And some of you, God has spoken to your heart tonight about something in your life that's not committed to Him. It's going to be a wall. You can't get over it. You can't go around it. It's right there. And you can memorize 10 billion memory verses. And you can pray 20 hours a day. But you're not going anywhere till you let Christ have victory in that. Over in England, there was an art gallery. There was a picture of a chess game. And there was a young artist that was kind of looking this picture over, and he happened to be a chess player, and apparently a pretty good one. He was looking at this thing, and underneath this game of chess was a word checkmate. And in the picture, sitting on the one side, was Satan, all painted red with horns and a tail, and he had a big leer on his face and had the appearance of the victor. Sitting across from him was a young man with his coat all disheveled, his hair in disarray, and he had the look of forlorn and complete defeat. Checkmate. And this guy studied that a little bit. And all of a sudden, throughout all the corridors, you could hear, young man, you've got to move. You've only got one, but you've got a move in which you can lick the devil. Those of you that have never come to know Christ, you've only got one move tonight to make. Those of you who have been convicted, challenged about something in your life, you've only got one move in order to lick the devil. You've got to get that thing surrendered and committed to Him. And tonight is the time to do that. I think, I don't know, is there a coffee break? Is there a coffee break tonight? Anybody know? No coffee. Good grief. I'll have to go to town for some coffee. You take me to town for some coffee? Before you go to town for coffee, I want you to spend the next 10 minutes with God. It's a beautiful evening, I think. I hope it hasn't started to rain. Just get out here and you spend 10 minutes with God. You may want to spend longer than that. But you spend 10 minutes with God alone.